Well, welcome here again, the first Sunday of Lent. Well, it uses a form we're not familiar with, or at least not very familiar with, unless we've studied the classics, myth. Myth to tell a story so true to our experience that it's one of the reasons we call it inspired. Our first reading from near the beginning of the book of Genesis captures the two sides of the human condition. On the one hand, we find ourselves amazingly alive and aware that our existence is made possible by and is located in the midst of an extraordinarily great gift. There is this freedom that we have as human beings to explore all the fruits of the earth. There's only one thing we shouldn't do: to live as if we're the masters, to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which, when I started my Hebrew studies, was surprised to learn is a literary technique, which means the totality of knowledge. To live as if we can use the gift of our existence in this garden to secure our future through mastery. This drive to dominate, it's rooted in our primal insecurity, our anxiety. And it's easily leveraged and exploited by the forces of evil, which tempt us to doubt God's good intentions to us. Did God really say? This doubt weasels away inside of us, causing us to question who we are and whether or not we have enough. Who you are and what you have is not enough. Those words resound like a gong down through the ages. And inevitably, played out, if we believe it, leads not only to the grasping after the ungraspable godlike mastery we want, but everything that comes right after our reading, the intense rivalry, the blaming and shaming that wrecks relationships, and that plays out in all of the tribalism and the power dynamics that still influence and shape all cultures. As the old saw puts it, when Adam saw what happened, he blamed Eve. Eve blamed the serpent, and the serpent, well, the serpent didn't have a leg to stand on. It's an, by the amount of laughter, I'm surprised how many of you haven't heard that before. And so we might be tempted to think this is just an old fable and therefore not relevant to us, but I think I'm already trying to demonstrate that it is clearly so, clearly speaks to us in our present circumstances. When right after Jesus is blessed at his baptism with the Holy Spirit descending on him, and the voice says, "You are my son, this is my son, the beloved, with whom I am well pleased," we're meant to hear all the echoes of Genesis in a transposed key. God's image, gifted with God's very presence in the garden of belovedness, if you will. We're meant to hear the freedom inherent in the gift, a life of boundless possibilities. Who you are, Jesus, and what you have is more than enough. And then the very next words, then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And we hold our collective breath. Will this image of God, this second Adam, as Paul the Apostle will name him in his most famous letter, will this Son of God, who begins in gift, begins in freedom, find himself bound by all the same kinds of insecurities, rivalries, and blame that has shackled the human race from time immemorial? Or is something else possible? It's the greatest of questions. And the scene that unfolds is also mythic in proportion. And we know what happens. Jesus wins a great triple victory. Whether to eat or not to eat, whether to exert power or not at that peak of the temple, whether to worship God or not at all. All coming at the end of extreme deprivation, so that we have amplified to a almost massive degree the eternal versus the temporal. And the story then lays bare its greatness, but also its seeming irrelevance. What does this have to do with us? We may be happy that Jesus won these victories, but what does it have to do with my life? Nothing, we might think. There's another old saw. We admire people for their strengths, but identify with them in their weaknesses. Here we have admirable strength that seems is actually way out of our league. So how is it relevant, or is it? We struggle to understand our lives as a wilderness. We would rather think of it as a garden. Our choices don't feel quite so binary as those described here. Since the 1960s, a few of us, a very small, tiny fraction of the human race, has been able to tell ourselves some fibs. The world is getting better. We're back in the garden, brought here by liberal democracy, market capitalism, socialist medicine, public education, technological innovation, to name just a few things. But those fibs don't really work so well anymore, do they? They never actually did. But it's amazing how we try and are able to distract ourselves, try to pretend that we've not all been cast out of the garden, that we're not really living in some wasteland of existentialist angst. I mean, as I was saying in my Ash Wednesday sermon, we're born and then we die, those two gates. And in between is this, as we grow older, seemingly almost insignificant duration. The first gate, we didn't choose to come through. And the second gate, we can't choose to avoid it. And we are far more likely to live well if we face this head on, as Jesus does here. Our text says that the Spirit led him into the wilderness. In Mark's gospel, that he was driven there by the Spirit. But in Luke's gospel, the Greek verb can be translated, Jesus brought himself back from the Jordan and into the wilderness. He was both led, compelled, and chose to face reality. All good psychotherapy, especially the one I favor, existentialist therapy, counsels us, like our scriptures, to face our lives head on, warts and all. In particular, we need to, and this is impossible to do without the gift of honesty, we need to stop blaming others for our troubles. Adam blamed Eve, yada, yada. If we can accept that we are, just as we are, the beloved, and the place that we find ourselves just is, with all of its challenges, with all of its beauties and all of its trials, with all that has gone before us, we may begin to see clearly the way forward is not through the types of things that the devil tempts Jesus with. Soothing ourselves with food or drink or sex or possessions or adventures or whatever it is that we tell ourselves will satiate us. Not through exerting a manipulating power that gets even with those in our life who irk us, that scratches an itch that is satisfied for a few days or weeks, and then it itches worse than ever. And certainly not through ignoring God's quiet presence, papering it over, pretending that we can escape the metaphysical gnawing at the deepest part of our soul. These coping techniques aren't coping at all, but they're efforts to turn away from reality. In the famous Paradise Lost, after Satan is cast from heaven, he says, "The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven." It's part of his defiant speech against God. And we too, in our mistrust of God, have often given in to this defiance of reality. It's a sad thing, but I've known several people who were sick and who somehow thought if they could just ignore it, ignore their sickness, it would go away. All the symptoms were there, but either through fear or anxiety, they just pretended it wasn't. And they died. This choice to face our lives is as stark as all of that. And Lent is the gift to us, these 40 days, mimicking, of course, Jesus's 40 days. And it can be a time, if we choose, of bringing a bracing clarity to our lives, to our relationships, to what we're pursuing, what we see as valuable in our life. Do we want to continue to live the way we are? Do we want to continue the journey of faith? Every year, it is a great gift of our tradition to bring us into this time and to be able to ask these clarifying questions. And the path we know, Jesus models it for us. Prayer, generosity, fasting, pruning for the sake of new growth. It's all grace, it's all a gift, and it's all meant to help us see again clearly that who we are and what we have is more than enough. But will we embrace it? We need each other's help to trust God in this way. I certainly need your help. Every year, I recognize again how much I need this time, how easily I've slipped into trusting in coping mechanisms that take me away from reality. Even in our story here today, the angels who Jesus resisted calling in the devil's prompt to throw himself off the temple and make a show, these angels do come and minister to Jesus. They aren't just tacked on to the end of the story. They're a critical part of Jesus' life. So we need others. The gift of grace, of a beloved identity, which we receive in our baptism, is not an arrival point, as Jesus so clearly shows us, but the beginning of our act of resistance to the way the world works, to its rivalries, its lusts, its grasping. In this Eucharist, we recognize that we are with him and he is with us in whatever wilderness we find ourselves in. And that, my friends, is the love and the courage, the glimpse of the garden we need to face whatever is ahead. May we all live a holy Lent.